it is. It's basketball. It's not a fucking soft sport.
I love it, Gabe. I love it.
Ladies and gentlemen, welcome back. Recording on Friday, the 24th of July. He's back, Boddy Nodge. He's been working on his memoirs, so we haven't had his thoughts on the NBL and the NBL free agency so far. So I ran a few things by Boddy on this episode. We talked about, was Damian Martin a better defender than Darnell Mee? We talked about Boddy's thoughts on the free agency signings thus far, in particular Isaac White from Stanford, the Brock Modem deal that's been on the table from the Perth Wildcats, Ruben Tarangi, Cam Glidden, a whole bunch of things. I also put the question to Boddy, will the Wildcats bend without Bendat? It's a question we both had. After a quick NBL talk, we branched off and we talked about the memoirs that Boddy is writing at the minute, which are available at boddynodge.com. And the first two chapters are up there. The rest are coming out at a later date. Boddy will talk about that. And then branching off from that again, we spoke about sports media as a profession and how it relates to the NBL and basketball coverage in Australia. We talk about what Boddy did in his journalistic career and how that could be emulated today and what it's going to take from a media perspective to get the NBL to a place of prominence in the Australian sporting landscape. Boddy talks about what he thinks of the positives of today and, of course, the negatives. This was a sprawling, wide-ranging chat, bordering on quite philosophical at times. I do hope you enjoy it. So we kind of push things in a different direction. I want to give a shout out and a thank you to Cam Luke, Liam Santa Maria, and Corey Williams. They had some kind words to say about me on their latest Market Watch podcast. I appreciate that. I'm sure if you're listening to this podcast, you're an NBL fan. So you're listening to Overtime and watching Overtime. But by G, if you're not, which is unlikely, but nonetheless, if you're not, subscribe to NBL podcasts now. It's on Apple and Spotify and a bunch of places. You've got Market Watch, you've got Overtime, you've got Rewind, you've got Adam Gibson's things. The content the NBL is putting out is eclectic and wide-ranging. You want signing talks? Tick. They don't float your boat. You want more personal one-on-one interviews? Adam Gibson goes one-on-one. You don't like even the modern NBL? You prefer to live in the past? Hey, the way things are at the minute, wouldn't blame you for a second. They've got classic content with NBL Rewind. Tick that off. You can hear Leonard Copeland speak. You've got everything. So get up off your derriere, sign up, share it, watch it. You know, there's no shame in sharing it to a fan or a person who's got zero interest in the sport of the NBL or a fair weather one. Why not? Bring it up at the kitchen table. Bring it up at a bar if you're allowed to go to one in whatever state you're listening. Looking forward for this podcast, though, NBL Pocket Podcast. Andrew Canyon, my partner in crime from the TBT coverage, he and I are hoping to record sometime next week, hopefully Tuesday, on a huge free agency episode, maybe even two, maybe even three. We're going to do team-by-team breakdowns of NBL 20 and each team's deficiency in NBL 20 and how the signings that teams have made to this point are going to help them change those deficiencies, and then just a few talking points about each team going forward. It could be quite a big one, and I hope people like that sort of thing. Lastly, before we jump into this episode, are you in the market for a book? Buy from Booktopia. They're a sponsor of the show. Use the link in the description. That's how they know you came from me here at the NBL Pocket Podcast. If you want the Jordan Rules after watching the Last Dance documentaries, they've got it. You want The Second Coming, the other Sam Smith book, that's on there too. You want to read Sprawlball about basketball analytics and become a little bit smarter about that sort of thing? Type that in, they've got it. These titles and many more, and it's my hope that they'll have the memoirs of this man in the near future. But right now, it's Boddy Nodge.
I'm going to start with Damian Martin. Obviously a great career. Everyone's said that 1,000 times. I don't need that again. Is he a better defender than Darnell Mee, Boddy?
No, but he is the most successful defender and the only person that I've seen that can influence a game through his defense. So I don't think that makes him better than Darnell. I think Darnell won the best defensive five times and Damian won it six. Interesting fact that's got nothing to do with anything, that they have the same initials. And they're defensive men, which is also the same initials. But honestly,
words and letters.
Look, when I think about it, the reason that we put Damian on a pedestal is multiple reasons. The first is that he's a great human being. Okay, that's established. The second is that his defensive prowess is such that it influences the result of games. Now, you can't say that about too many defenders. But the reason that we focus on that so much is because, you know, offensively he doesn't bring much at all. So the defense is the focus. And when you're just focusing on that, then right. You say, yes, he is the best. And the third aspect of Damian Martin is that he is an outstanding leader, one of the greatest captains we've seen in the history of the NBL. So there's a lot to justify the league revealing that they're going to call the Best Defensive Player Award the Damian Martin Award. I think that is a fantastic thing, and I'm 100% behind it. So I think we've discussed before, I anticipated that he was going to retire. He was starting to just look like he was ready to retire, like it was getting harder to get up for games and stay up for games. And I think he's made a great decision, because when you leave and people still think you should be playing, that's a great time to go.
Yeah, right, totally.
And we've had that with a couple of them. Let's not forget Ty Wesley.
We've had three in the one season. Lish, yep, Martin, and Wesley. And Medjin as well,
four. And Medjin, four. So,
and maybe
so
Bogut, five.
Well, yeah, quite possibly. So, it's a bit of a loss for the league. But I can't speak highly enough of Damian Martin. In anything I've had to do with him, he's been a delight and a professional and just, he's the sort of person you want your daughter to marry.
That's high praise. I think the other thing I say, why can't we have our cake and eat it too and call it the Day Me and Martin Award, which is the me spelled M. Darnell Me, though, going back to him, he retires in 2009, won the Tobago Bunch. Was there ever any talk of giving him the trophy? Because I think the other thing with Damian Martin is terms of service. Came to the NBL, didn't play overseas, played his whole career in the NBL. Darnell, I think, in the middle there, departed overseas, didn't he?
Yes, after the debacle of the semi-final loss to the Illawarra, I think they were Wollongong Hawks at that time in 2001, where he was called for that foul on Damon Lowry's shot as the siren sounded. I just think he couldn't, and then he made the three free throws, which won him the game. And then they went on to win the championship. So that was a destiny type situation. But Darnell was really shattered by that. And that's why he left. He just needed to get out of our league. So had that not occurred, then I don't think we would have had the break. But I think we're pretty happy when he came back.
To put a bit, like Damian Martin plays from 07 to 2020, presiding over what is arguably sort of the NBL's one of its lower periods as far as talent and the way the league was shaping and everything. Was there ever any talk of Damian Martin going overseas? You covered the league all through that time. Was he ever thought of, oh, he might go here or there, or was he just an NBL guy?
No, I think I don't recall any conversations of that nature or much debate about that. When there was talk about who are NBA prospects, who are European prospects, the names were more like Martin Catalini and Sam McKinnon. He was kind of seen as a great NBL player, and that's what he is. He was a great NBL player. Sure. But I think probably if you're looking at an overseas situation, then you've got to look at his overall game. And then that lack of offense then does stand out a bit.
Let's go on. Staying with the Wildcats, so Brock Modem has rumored been offered a contract by the Wildcats.
They've got to replace Nick Kay.
Yeah. How well do you think he'd play? I mean, he didn't even make the World Cup team over Glidden and Sobey, after all.
And Glidden is out of Brisbane now. What a funny coincidence. He's very much in the elite level of NBL player for sure. So if they were to pick him up, I don't think they would have lost terribly much. Going by the season he had here in Adelaide with the 36ers, he's very much up to the level and on the top tier of that level. So if they were to get him, they would be in extremely good shape, let me tell you.
Glidden, Sobey, we were talking about them before. They've speaking of Brisbane, I guess. Brisbane have signed Froling and Drew Mick.
What a shock. That's shocking for me. And that means they've now got three centers counting Hodgson and Magne. I guess one of those might go. We'll see.
Unless they go with one import. That's all I wanted to hear. Yeah. That's really NBL news. Oh, Isaac White, Adelaide kid. We actually spoke about him briefly.
Yes,
you know,
I'm disappointed from a 36ers perspective because I got to see a little bit of this young man playing for Sturt, and he had a lot of promise. And now what he's done overseas in college, I think he was a really bad loss for the 36ers. And I think it's a bad loss from the point of view is that you'd still like to see some local kids on your local team. I know that's the thing of the past. I mean, but I go back to that when the 36ers began. It was pretty much a couple of imports, you know, Bill Jones, Mark Davis, and all South Australians. Now, I know that that's not a situation that exists now because it's an entertainment business and you're trying to put the best team on the floor wherever you get the guys from. But when a kid like Isaac White becomes available, you know, you want to be all over that. You don't want him to be going to the Hawks. Now, from his point of view, playing for Brian Goorjian, that's a great career step. So I have no qualms about Isaac's decision. I just think it's a shame the 36ers didn't really roll out the red carpet as much as they probably should have to get him here.
Yeah. I want to talk about South East Melbourne. Who do you think is going to turn around more on that team? They've taken two guys from Brisbane who didn't have the year they wanted. Ruben Tarangi, Glidden. Who do you think suits that team better? Who do you think was the most sort of dogpiled on in Brisbane?
Tarangi. There's aspects of Tarangi.
He appeals to me.
Yeah, he reminds me of a Mitch Creek a little bit. Mm. If you could just let him go, let him sort of get into it, I think he could be that sort of player. So, but then you go, oh, do they already have that player then in Mitch Creek? Mm. So, and Glidden, I'm sorry, I've said this before on your program that I think Glidden is a great player on alternate weeks. You know, right. He's going to come out and shoot 30 and kill you. And then he's going to go two for 15 the next week. And that is why I've always sort of been reluctant to have him in that upper echelon of player, because until he delivers consistently, and by consistently, I mean week in, week out, so that when you get to the end of his
career. 4 minutes on the floor too. Yeah.
Yeah. And so that you can get to the end of his career and turn back and say, he had a great career and you can't remember his best game because there were so many. All right. When you can turn around and go, yeah, last year he went 36 points against so-and-so. So, well, okay, the fact that you remember that means he didn't have that great a year. Mm. Do you know what I mean? Unless it's you know, an Al Green 71 point game or something.
Right. Yeah,
that's different. But what I'm saying is he's not at that level consistently. And that's what I feel about Todd Blanchfield too. I think Todd Blanchfield is full of talent. I saw him playing here years ago in Adelaide at that tournament that Jeff Van Groningen organised, where people bought teams and whatever, and Chris Golding, a lot of young guys played in that. I saw Blanchfield then. I thought, this guy is laden with talent, just needs the right environment. Well, he's had a few environments, and the best one for him obviously was under Sean Dennis at Townsville, same as Clint Steindl, and maybe getting into that Perth situation. Steindl's there, Trevor Gleeson. Yeah, you know, you go back to that sort of Townsville connection. Maybe we'll see that from him, because I felt Todd is another one that has not consistently come out and kicked butt. He will come out and do that, but then he'll seem to have a game or two off. Maybe that Perth Wildcats environment where you're expected to bring it every day without fail in front of that red army of 13,000, maybe that's what he needs to just get over the hump. And then you're looking at him and Modem, and it's starting to look pretty good.
Going back to Tarangi and South East Melbourne there, I just want to say, I feel you saw how well Tarangi played in that game against Australia for New Zealand.
Oh, yeah.
I feel like Piero Cameron, other than the stature, obviously, they're very different, but him and Simon Mitchell seem to, I just don't know why, I think they have a similarity or a synergy or mirror each other kind of in the sort of confidence, in the shoot the ball motto type thing. Yeah. So I think that might play well to Tarangi as well.
Yeah.
Going back to Blanchfield, if you're the Wildcats, would you have chosen Glidden or Blanchfield if that was an opportunity?
I think Glidden is from Western Australia, so I'm surprised that they didn't get him. But no, I like Blanchfield. I think that's a, if I was selecting, well, I think Blanchfield brings a bit more. Plus, I don't, no offence to Cam Glidden, although if he's listening to this, he probably will take offence. But Blanchfield doesn't tend to fall over as much on defence, is all I'm going to say.
Spells the end of Tarico White. I think we all saw it coming.
Oh, yeah.
Once they lost Kay, it was obvious they were going to replace the spot with an import. it does throw up into my mind the question of, I mean, they were chasing a three-peat. You know, they were going for it. And the idea of cutting it short, it's just, I find it a little bit deflating. What was your reaction knowing that he wasn't be back? And I guess my broader question is, what's the value of a three-peat in the NBL? In the NBA, it would be, no, we're going for a third. We're going to re-up. We're going to do it. The NBL's got a different meaning. What's your sort of take on the whole thing?
Well, in the NBA, you've got 30 teams. So if you can get a three-peat, you know, yeah, right, that's a really good effort. Here we've got 8 or 9 teams in any given year. So three-peat shouldn't be anywhere near as difficult. It should be like, you know, a third as difficult or a tenth, whatever it is. I'm not able to do the math.
Just over a tenth.
Yeah. So, you know, what makes it a big deal is that it doesn't happen all that often. In fact, I think it's only happened the one time with the Kings. So, yeah, it's something everybody aspires to achieve, and obviously the Wildcats are the only ones in the position to do that.
Do you think Tariqa White and Cotton and that group deserve the right to go for it again, or is that not how basketball works? You don't deserve anything.
Are you going on the Chicago Bulls model here?
Yeah, a little bit.
Yeah, and I while I agree with Jordan that they should have been allowed to defend that for a fourth, you know, go for the fourth in a row. Before the club chose to break it up, it's a little bit different here because you've got, people aren't trading players. The
coronavirus is the big one. That's why the imports are cut. If it wasn't for that, they wouldn't be cut. You'd probably still be there.
Yeah. Here's the thing, though, and I know we're sort of deep into this conversation. The thing we haven't discussed is: are we sure we're going to have a season? Are we really sure we're going to have a season? Because last time I looked, we've got 2 teams from Melbourne in this competition, and Victoria is not exactly setting the world on fire in terms of controlling the COVID-19 situation. So, and are we in a position where you could take the 2 teams out of Victoria and put them in a hub, somewhere? You know, I don't think so. And I think the WNBL also is very much in jeopardy. They have 8 teams, 3 of them based in Victoria. There's no money whatsoever to put them in some sort of hub. So I'm just curious to see where we go, where COVID allows our sport to go right now. I'm not confident. I want to be. I'm looking at the player movements in both competitions, NBL and WNBL. I'm thinking there's some good-looking teams here that I want to see playing.
Yeah.
I just don't know if the circumstances are going to be right.
Speaking of sort of uncertain circumstances, Jack Bendat selling the Wildcats. Thoughts?
Well, a long time ago, I had a conversation with a very prominent West Australian, whose name I'm not going to drop just in case he doesn't want me to say this publicly, but it's somebody that we all know and respect and had to look and literally look up to. And I was talking with this gentleman. I'm not going to give you his initials. It's not Leroy Loggins. Anyway, I was talking to him about how well the Wildcats are going, you know, in terms of how well they service their audience, their sponsors, you know, how professional that organization is, and that there's no surprise, therefore, that they are the blueprint for success in our basketball world. And this particular person just leaned back and said, yeah, but you take Jack Bendat out of the equation and that comes straight back to the field.
Oh, I suppose he said that. Have you met Jack Bendat or hear stories?
Oh, no. It's what I know about Jack Bendat is he wants to win. Absolutely.
At any and all costs, yeah.
At any and all cost. And the cost is not an issue. So, therefore, you take that particular element out, and it becomes an issue as it is for every other club. Right. They come back to the field. So he's been a huge part of that club's success, you know, just because he's prepared to fund that success. And whether that will continue under any new ownership model, that remains to be seen. So I think that is one of the biggest off-season situations that will probably get the least amount of attention, but it will impact on that program heavily.
Do you know him? Is he quite hands-on, or is it just literally season ends? He's like, we didn't win. We're cutting the bottom 10%. Keep the top 10%. You know what I mean? You don't know whether he's like that or not.
I know that he's very much a straight up businessman, and it's about winning. And when he had Nick Marvin there, Nick took care of all the business. And I think now Troy takes care of the business. So he's not actively involved. He's not a micromanager. Yeah, he's not like that.
Do you think that's the best structure for sports ownership in general and sports ownership in basketball in Australia?
I really don't know. Because I've seen so many variations of it, and some work, some don't. Some work for a while, and then, I mean, the Wildcats situation has worked for a long time. But go back to prior to Jack Bendat, to when there was a period there where Andrew Vlahov and Luke Longley owned the team, and they got financially burnt. And go back prior to that and keep going, you know, you sort of go, well, right. Perth wasn't always where it is now. And its most prolonged period of success has come under the ownership of Jack Bendat. So I don't know if that's the ideal model. It seems to be on the basis of what I've just said, but how many other Jack Bendats exist that love the sport
exactly.
as much? You know, in this country.
This is what I'm interested to see, because it's going to go from Bendat, who was a philanthropist. It was basically a charity for him that he did for a bit of fun. Can you now take the Wildcats, the most successful both on court and off, and monetarily wise, presumably, does the model hold up? You know, without Bendat, does it hold up in a situation where, you know, a team's trying to make an owner's trying to make money off the Wildcats or trying to do something differently? Or is the NBL purely a league that owners come in and kind of, you know, have a bit of fun with the team and I own a team, look at me, but aren't taking it in that sort of business and serious sense? We're about to get a real examination into it once this sells.
Yes, we are, because I think you've got it right. For a lot of people that come in, it's exciting at first to own a team and, you know, have all your friends in the box and, you know, strut around, I own a sporting team. And then the realities of the financials start to hit after a while. And you go, you know, is this really going as well as what I hope? So you see changes in ownership fairly consistently. So, it's going to be very interesting to see how that situation plays out in Perth. I don't think there'll be any immediate impact. Like, I don't think that's going to impact heavily on this season, presuming it goes ahead. But over the next 2 years, we'll see what happens.
I guess that's really it for NBL news. Deng Adel signed, pretty big name. Like, does he blow your skirt up?
Yeah, he does a little bit. Yeah. I get, oh, quite the breeze. and I've got a few others there. Is Deng Deng there as well?
Deng Deng and Deng Adel.
Yeah.
So ring the bell. Ding, ding, ding. I think Greta's the one I like. I think Greta, he's healthy. I think I liked his game. I like the way he attacked the basket.
So do I.
And
he's got a little bit of the Larry Bird look about him. Not as a player, just
hair, facial. Moustache going on. Yep, yeah, I see that totally. That's enough for the NBL. I want to talk about your memoirs that you're writing.
Goodness.
First thing.
Okay, time for everyone to tune out.
What's your process and condition of writing these? Are you up and quiet? Do you listen to music? What's your structure?
Honestly, I put on a CD of some description. It's been a Little River Band CD
with lyrics. You can write your own words. I'm surprised.
Yeah, it just plays, it's sort of like I get lulled. I don't hear it anymore. It's just a noise. But, you know, like when I'm writing a particular period, if Cat Stevens was relevant at that time, I'll be playing Tea for the Tiller Man album or Teaser and the Firecat in the background. Just, it's not really for me to pay attention to. It's just there, and it kind of almost sets a mood and takes me back there. I want to talk about the James Taylor One Man Dog album, so I'll flick that on, and that'll be playing while I'm writing about stuff from that period. And actually it helps transport me. I mean, you know, if there's certain songs you will hear that will immediately spark a memory for you, or certain, you know, and so when I put music on from the particular eras, that really, really helps, because I'm not paying attention to the music. It's just taking me back to that sort of time.
Tarantino does the same thing. So when he wrote Pulp Fiction, he listened to all those songs, and that's why they naturally made their way into the film. It does the same thing. What are you enjoying most about the experience? Are you enjoying the nostalgia? Are you enjoying the actual physical writing? What do you prefer?
I don't think there's too many writers who actually enjoy the physical writing,
right.
You know, hitting the keyboard and doing that. I think you like seeing what comes up and that reading what you put down. But I think what I like about it is that I'm actually realizing that that my family had a big role to play in life as it went. You know, like I as I said to you before, we hit record on the podcast, that the danger is you think, I'm going to write my memoirs, and you think, well, who's going to give a toss? Like, who are you? Like, what have you done? Well, you're just another, you know, everybody's got a story to tell, so why should my story be more interesting than yours or the next person or the next person? So that's the bit you got to get over. Is it just your own arrogance or self-indulgence or stupidity? You know, right. So you start off, and you think, well, maybe I've got a story to tell that is interesting. And so you just get into it. And then suddenly, by going back through your memories, and I've got journals and photographs, and anything that's factual in this book is accurate. It's spot on. Like if I say a date, that's exactly the date, because right. I've got access to that information. Because I'm, I wouldn't say I'm a hoarder, but there's a lot of stuff around here. Jesus. Anyway, you don't want to come in here with a flamethrower, because, yeah. Anyway, so in going back and revisiting memories, I found that my family, actually, because of their Hungarianness, they had an impact on the Hungarian community. Because of my brother's height, they had an impact on the basketball community. So I'm sort of telling, it's a bit like when I wrote Marvelous. It wasn't so much just about Brett Maher, the book. It was about Brett Maher's place in the history of what was going on around him. So this book isn't so much about me as much as what was also going on around me. And I think my family has a fabulous story to tell. My parents are just extraordinary people. When I look at the fact that, you know, I've opened the front door and Rudolf Nureyev is standing there, you know, and I don't know that, I mean, those people that know ballet will go, oh, gee, that. And those people who don't know who Rudolf Nureyev is think probably that the reindeer was named after him or something. But he was like a really huge international entertainment, you know, commodity, celebrity star. And there he is at our front door coming to try and recruit my brother to the Australian Ballet. And I sort of look back on that and go, that's actually pretty interesting. you know, I might actually write that. And then I find, you know, the history of my family and their involvement, the rest of my family back in Hungary and their involvement in the Hungarian Revolution.
I enjoyed that chapter.
Yeah. And so I've just finished off another chapter 10, which is, it talks about when I first went back to Hungary and my uncle is there. And some of the stuff that happens while I'm in Hungary, I think is pretty interesting. I hope it's interesting. I found it interesting. So I hope someone else does.
You go, buddy. Yep.
I was just going to say, I've really only sent, as I finish each chapter, I send it to two of my brothers, and they read it and they come back to me with their critiques, and actually I've emotionally disturbed them a couple of times. They've come back crying, and they didn't know things that had happened within our own family, because it's a big family. You know, there was 11 on a certain stage.
What I wanted to ask you was, and I don't want to preempt any chapters of the book, but you tell me as much or as little. I've got your birth date here. Do you want me to, do you mind me sharing that, or do you want me to keep that private?
Well, it's just a maths equation, isn't it? 28 to 56. Yeah.
56. Which makes you child of the Vietnam War, 55 to 75 in its entirety. It hasn't come up in the two chapters I've read so far. But what I've got written here is real watershed moment for not just the world, but the media, especially, and newspapers and the way they're written, and journalistic integrity and political integrity and the way they interact. What did you feel it, or looking back now, do you feel it as a pivotal time where that's why you went into journalism, or guys like Neil Sheehan, you know, New York Post and all that sort of stuff? Was it as big an issue as I think it may have been for you?
When I started at the news, the general reporter's room was filled with such incredible talent and people who just wanted the truth and wanted to write it well. And we were the tabloid. We were the paper that was trying to grab people, the afternoon paper that was trying to grab people coming out of their office buildings with, you know, garish headlines and things that would make them buy a paper. We weren't the paper of record, the advertiser, which was delivered on your lawn. So so you would have thought that maybe the standard or the quality of our journalists was somewhat less than the advertiser, the broadsheet, the paper of record. But that wasn't the case. When I got there, I was just blown away by the credibility, the intensity, the meticulousness to detail. You know, it was fantastic. I just thought, I've got to be a part of this. I have to be a part of this because this is so exciting. This is such an exciting environment to be in. And to be non-specific, I mean, there are very specific journalists, political journalists, sporting journalists, you know, people who are doing the council rounds, whatever, the police unit. But to be non-specific, just to be in the general reporter's room, meant every day when you showed up to work, you didn't know what was coming. You had no idea where you were going to go in the chief of staff's office, and he was going to hand you your assignment, and it could be anything. There's a bus accident, you know, head down there. There's a train derailment. There's a fashion show. You didn't know what you were going to get. So, just walking through the door every day was exciting. I loved that whole atmosphere. My first working day as a journalist, I'll preempt something that's coming up in the book, was the day that Maslin's Beach in South Australia became the first nudist only beach in Australia. That was my first day of work. Guess what my first assignment was? Yeah, first assignment, go out and interview the people.
No way.
Yeah. So there's my first story.
I feel that can go both ways. It can go both ways.
Oh, yeah, it sure did. Yeah. It can go a lot of ways. That's one of those times when you can't actually, you can look, but you cannot see. Because if you see, you might react. You don't want to do
the working title of the memoirs. And it is, if you don't mind relaying it for people.
No, it's a type of life, and then I forget the second bit. You probably got it there.
I don't. I just, the one word that it does have in there is infamy, and we talk.
Yeah, the journey of some. A journey. I think it's the journey of an ethnic kid to basketball. Yeah. Infamy. Yeah, because infamy.
Why that word?
Well, I think there's been times in my writing career as a basketball journalist where I have been a little bit infamous for being prepared to say what others aren't, and being a little bit sarcastic, hopefully a little bit humorous, try to be always as accurate as possible, because you can't really, if you're a clown, no one takes you seriously. And if you're too serious, well, people get a little tired of the fact that there's no fun. So I tried to blend that. And in doing that, you know, there were many people that I alienated. There was a period when Brian Gorgian was coaching Eastside Spectres, and then on to the Magic, and then the Titans. And they had a very strong rivalry going at the time with the 36ers. So I kind of had a lot of fun at his expense. there were many things that occurred during that particular period. And I had friends in Melbourne, journalists in Melbourne, like Grantley Bernard, who was working for the Herald Sun at that time, and Stephen Howell, who was working for The Age, two fabulous journos that we've lost, not to life, but to basketball, sadly.
Right.
And they would tell me that Brian would be aware of what I had written, and he never called me Buddy Nudge. It was always the fucking Buddy Nudge. That fucking Buddy Nudge. That's what it was all the time. So
that's great, though. That's healthy.
I used to have a column on Thursdays called Around the NBL, where I just used to have news items, but also I used to pull a Mickey out of things. And they'd go into his timeouts, and he would say thing a lot, you know. So I would write whole sentences where you've replaced every major word with thing, so that the sentence was basically incoherent. And I'd say, this is a Brian Gorgian timeout, that sort of thing. Buddy Nudge. So one time I'm walking down Goodwood Road here in Adelaide, and there's an antique store, and it's got all these old vinyl records lined up, you know, for a buck. And one of them is 40 songs with the word thing.
No, you took a snap.
Yes, yes. No, I didn't take a snap. I did not. I paid the dollar.
Of course.
Got it wrapped, went to the post office, asked Grantley Bernard for Brian Gorgian's address.
And sent it to him.
And I sent it to him, and the sender was FBN.
Perfect.
I figured he worked it out. But you know, Brian, yeah. I love Brian. I saw him in Singapore a few years ago. It was like a long lost brother. So it's not, these things aren't carried on. But at the time, you know, when everybody's in the middle of their own reputation or building of their reputation, and they see themselves a certain way, there's some guy in Adelaide pulling the piss out of everything. You get a bit infamous.
And that's where I was talking about the Vietnam War before. And I think the journalists at that time, the one word that you couldn't describe them as being self-preservatory. And I feel like in a way you're much like that. There's the thought of self-preservation is not high on people of that era's, and it comes across in your memoirs and things. Did you find that yourself?
Yeah, but see, times have changed. You see, when I was a young journalist starting in the game, like I said, I was in awe of the people I was working with. I studied what they were doing and how they did it to try and be the best possible version of myself. And life was different. Everybody needed to have a newspaper that brought you what you needed to know, okay? And it was run by newspaper men and newspaper women. And at a certain point, newspapers became run by accountants. And once you're run by an accountant, now you've got shareholders, now you've got people who want to see profits. So now there's a shift. Initially, it's subtle, but it's a shift away from the information you need to read to be an educated person about what's going on in life around you that may impact on you. That becomes less important. And what becomes more important is that you buy the paper. So now with the advent of social media as such a powerful tool, it's now about clicks and about self-preservation. Exactly. So a journalist now will be reluctant to criticize a sporting team, no matter how they're going, but he'll be reluctant to do it in print for fear of the repercussion where that team may just say, "We're never talking to you again."
Restrict access.
And also, everybody now, or those that are sort of trying to modernize and keep up with the times, have their own websites, have their own writers. So now, you know, if you want to write about the Adelaide Crows, well, the Adelaide Crows have got their own journalists churning stuff out for their website and their fan base. They don't need the paper anymore. At a time, I mean, they do need the paper, and the public needs the paper to tell the true stories of things, because clubs will only ever give you their version, their whitewashed version of events, especially if one of their charges or players or coaches or whatever is in some sort of difficulty with the law, or you know, they're going to give you the whitewashed version. And that's when you need newspapers to be that powerful tool that they were, but they're not. And it's easy to accuse them of fake news because there's a lot of crap in them. There's a lot of crap. And that journalists today don't have the access that I had. When I was writing, I had the phone number of every player that was of any relevance, and I could ring them. You know, and I would never take advantage. I'm not going to ring him at midnight, you know, drunk call. Hey, guess who this is, mate? No, I'm not going to do any of that shit. You did it right, and people respected you. You rang him at times, and he says, "If this is inconvenient, I can ring you at another time," etc. And they wanted to talk to you because they wanted the publicity. The sport needed the publicity, so you were in a much stronger position than now, where it's the opposite, where they don't think they need you. In fact, you're a bit of a problem. They want to control the news. What? They want to control the narrative. And it's happening all over.
That's my question to you. What's the marriage? What's the healthy balance? Because you need a team needs to have its, the way it puts itself out there. But they need the thing. Where do you see it in the modern age? It's a really difficult question to answer. But in the modern age, where's the balance?
I think the things that the established media has failed to recognize, or if it's recognized, it's failed to fully embrace it, is that people would like analysis, and that's what they can provide in a way that a 30-second item on television or some bullhead story on Facebook or whatever can't give you real analysis of what's going on in a particular issue, and also to take events forward. You know, when we went to the digital age, you know, I would write a story, and it would be appearing in Tomorrow's Advertiser. But before it appeared in Tomorrow's Advertiser, it would appear online today. So if you are an avid reader of a basketball story, you would go online, you'd
find the paper. Okay.
And then the next day, you're at a cafe and you read the paper, I've already read this story. And I thought that was stupid of us as an industry. Right. I thought what we should have been doing is, I'll give you a prime example. When Peter Buckle was sacked as coach of the Lightning, I wrote that story. It went up online almost immediately, and then they took it and they put it in the paper for the next day. Now, I thought that's stupid. What we should be doing is advancing that story. And I found out later that same day that Rich Dickel would be the new coach. So I wrote a piece
timeline,
and I went to the sub-editor and said, ditch that story. Here's a story. So now, if you've gone online on a particular day, you've seen, Peter Buckle got sacked. That's a shock. And then the next day you go to the paper, Rich Dickel's a new coach.
Right.
So now that's how it should be working. Not next day you read, Peter Buckle. I already knew that. I knew that yesterday. And I think there's been a lot of mistakes made by established media because it's terrified of its inability to break stories. If a bomb goes off in your street right now, you can look out the window and just tweet or Instagram,
buddy,
whatever.
I have to interrupt you, buddy. Actually, there has been an explosion down the street. I get it.
Okay. Yeah, please put it up online immediately.
Oh, photos, whatever.
So what'll happen is you can break that. You can break that story. There's a bomb just gone off. So I will look, because I follow you, I'll go, oh look, there's a bomb gone off. Now, if I want to know what that's about, who set the bomb, I've got to go to established media. Right. Okay? So that's where they need to get that next part right. But because they're so terrified of their inability to break stories anymore, because that was so important and such a part of the competitive environment between media organizations, that there's a real terror. So now it becomes, I'll write a story about somebody, that this great left-handed basketballer, and a lot of that gets a lot of clicks online. Oh, geez, let's do a story about left-handed baseball, left-handed cricketer, left-handed netballer. Right. We're just going to bombard you until we see that that falls away. And ultimately what will happen in established media is that how many clicks you get will determine how you're rated as a journalist. So it'll become even worse because you want to sensationalize. You'll go out with half-assed facts because you want to be first and getting the clicks. And so it's going to get worse before it gets better, which is tragic for the industry.
Let's say that's all the gloom. Is there anything that you look at now and you think, oh, that's an improvement, or that's better? Or if you were starting out today, that you would look at and go, oh, that's a real avenue that I would pursue.
No, honestly, if I was starting out today, I'd go into a different business, because I've got no real confidence in the media for the next 5 years, and then I'm hoping that it'll pull itself out of where it is now. But once you're shutting down community newspapers, you're shutting down regional newspapers, you're taking away the people's access to information, and you're dumbing down everything. And that can't be a good thing for society. That's when charlatans will get away with all kinds of things. So I would hate to be getting into the media industry today. When I got in, as I said, I was awestruck by what the people I was working with. Right. And I felt I had to reach a certain standard all the time with what I was writing. I had to be spot on. And right now it's quite the opposite. And there's this cult of me now where people have to insert themselves into stories and say things such as, as we were chatting down the line from Bristol to England, and all that kind of, that was me doing
I
that.
I stimped my asparagus soup ever so undersalted.
And he was talking about the problem of alcoholism, and here I am with an 18-year-old thinking, yes, I've got the same. Oh, look, keep yourself out of the story. You're not the story.
The Michael Moore stuff. Yeah, the Michael Moore story.
Yeah. Get out of that. That's crap. Write the story, and if you've got something interesting to say subsequent to that, then put it in your confidential page or your page where you've got your little fun things, or allegedly fun things. Right. But I tell you, when I knew I had to get out, was while I was on leave, I got a note saying that when you come back, you'll have to be part of this new order, which will be that twice a week everyone has to come in at 5:30 a.m. to monitor the social media accounts of people like Tex Walker from the Crows and Travis Boak from Port Adelaide, and Rory Sloane, just to see what they're saying, because that apparently is freaking news. If that's what news is today, I don't want any part of it.
Just stay with that. Sports journalism. Sam Smith, author of the Jordan Rules, quite famous guy. Yeah. He writes,
yes,
sports is entertainment. So he deems sports writing is sort of like entertainment writing. Is he right? Yeah. Is he wrong? Do you like that comparison?
I do.
At its height.
I think that is right. I think you have to entertain, because it's not life and death. We're not talking about wartime situations in Bosnia or something, life and death. We're talking about sport. I mean, I know sport can feel like life and death for that really hardened fan, but it's sport. It's entertainment. It's in our situation, it's men running around in shorts or you know that sort of thing. It's and they're getting paid for it, and paid well. So you can't really be taking that seriously. And I think this whole COVID situation has really open the world's eyes to who's important and who's relevant and who isn't. And, you know, it's I think I read somewhere where some nurse was asked as to why there hadn't been a vaccine. And she just quoted the amount of money that's being paid to Ronaldo or Messi and said, well, maybe if we got that sort of money here instead of our, you know, $249 a week, we might be. And it's all like, wow, yeah, you're right. We need to pull our heads in. So, yeah, I do think it's entertainment. And I always tried to write in an entertaining way. And I think that's why I had a bit of an audience.
What was I going to say? When you were writing for the paper, because I only know you through a blog, right? When you're writing for the paper, what sort of stuff were you putting out? You were writing weekly or daily about the NBL?
Daily.
I was a full-time. So what was the conversation there? I don't know how did you sustain it and how did you, you know, keep it good? What were your aims?
My aim as a basketball writer, someone who was employed to write basketball, and I don't think there were too many of us, to do that exclusively. I mean, I look at, say, a Matt Logue at the Daily Telegraph. He's doing
it's awfully
league
rare.
And doing basketball. Yeah, but I had got to that point where I had a strong enough position to be a basketball writer purely. And so then I thought, well, if that's what I'm going to be, then there has to be basketball in the paper every single day. So I was on the phone every day to the 36ers, to the Lightning as our preeminent teams. And prior to that, I was on the phone every day to West Adelaide and to Glenelg and then West Torrens.
What was the conversation? Saying what's the story?
What's happening? Like, what happened to training today? Anyone get hurt? Is there, you know, anything coming? You got a new sponsor? You know, every day I would be coming in, and they knew I was coming. And it used to really piss the TV channels off. They were so annoyed at me, the TV news. They're saying, oh, Bonnie Nose is getting all the stories. You know, what about giving us a story? It's like, well, this guy rings us every freaking day. He's all over it, you know.
Did they the clubs begrudge you calling them every day like that?
No, because they were getting publicity. They're getting publicity of a type they'd never had before, because now there was a guy that was doing it full time. And I felt if the paper came out and did not have a basketball story in it, and I wasn't having a day off the day before, then I had failed in my job. And I didn't want to fail in my job. I wanted to be an absolute success. So every day there was some sort of update. There's an upcoming game, you know, what relevance that has. Every day I would find angles. And the thing about it too was that I was so fortunate with sports editors who just trusted me and said, leave him to it. And I would come in with a story, you know, I would hand them a story and I'd go, gee, this is a good one. And if I knew I was onto a real barn burner, then I'd obviously tip them off saying, you know, this could be back page or this could be, you know, a really prominent, maybe we need a feature on this. And that's how I went about it. But they left me to my own devices. So most of the coverage of basketball that we had in South Australia was off my own bat. And I'm proud of that. I'm really, really proud of that. And I'm proud of the fact that they had that faith in me and knew that whatever I wrote was spot on and it was going to be accurate. They didn't have to worry. I got sued once in a 43-year career. I got sued once.
Right. by whom? Are you comfortable telling?
No. No, I'm not comfortable telling. No. Unfortunately, the managing editor wanted to fight it because we would have won. We would have won it. But the managing editor, he said, don't worry, we're back here. We'll take this to court. We'll kill him. And then he went on holidays. Unfortunately. And then while he was on holidays, I said, papers are being run by accountants by now. They just said, let's give them 10 grand and piss them off. So I lost that one.
Looking at that, about writing about the NBL and basketball every day, and were you writing about the NBL mostly or?
NBL, WNBL, district competition. On Fridays in the newspaper, I would have previews of the under 20 men's games. You know, whatever I could find, I was writing.
But under the umbrella of basketball.
Yeah. Yep.
Do you think, like, what would you do if someone tapped you on the shoulder and said you're in charge of media strategy for the NBL? Would you reenact what you did there and have a person in every state or city covering the basketball, or would you, you know, how do you take this up? And I'm going to quote something you said to me, and if you don't like it, I'll definitely cut it out. But you said to me, we're 40 years into this, the NBL, and not enough people give a shit. Are you comfortable with me leaving that in?
Yeah, absolutely. It's a fact. It's a fact.
So how do you change that? Is my question to you, having been a long-standing journalist. You know, what do you?
Well, look, I think the move that is happening now in all sport, where as I said, everybody's got their own website, everyone's got their own journalist or people that they employ to write stories for their fan base, and the sad reality of that is that they think they're in control, that we're controlling the information, and clubs want to control the information. And that's a recipe for let's just say it's not a recipe for success, because you're only preaching to the converted. You're only preaching to your members or the people that are interested. When you go into mainstream media, you don't know who's going to read that story or who's going to look at that picture or who's going to watch that news item. You don't know, but you're exposing yourself to a far vaster audience. You know, and I think that's a huge mistake that with the NBL, WNBL, whatever they make, they think, oh, we've got our own people. And the clubs, you know, there are several journalists I know that hate dealing with the PR people or the media people at some of the clubs because they just want to control. Why do you want to know that? Why do you want to speak to this particular person? What's your story angle? And then if you tell them, they'll go away and tell their own journalists and they'll produce it for their own website. It's ridiculous. So I think the league needs to stop wanting to just put out puff pieces on all these wonderful new signings, and isn't this delightful? You know, everything's just hunky dory, just going so very, very well. And it's
very lispy there, by the way.
Yeah, so
that's my question to you.
Little gay there. Jesus, even my wrist is limp. What the hell happened here? Anyway, sorry.
It's like, where do you find that balance between, is negativity a bad thing? What sells tickets? How do you, you know, use the media as a mechanism to sell tickets and seats? Increase, that's always been an equation. It's very difficult.
No, there's an old saying that you would have heard: good publicity, bad publicity, it's all publicity. And if you've written something that is of a negative aspect of the sport, something's gone wrong, or something that has been handled poorly, or whatever, what does that create? It creates discussion and debate. Yeah. People are going, what do you think of that? They let that guy off and he slugged the other bloke in the face. Yeah, but he plays for this club. And now there's, you know, you get debate, you get discussion, you get interest. All right.
And that gets sales tickets.
Yeah. And you just, but you just keep telling people how wonderful everything is. And then that isn't true. And people know that you know, it might, that the duck might be going slowly, but it's paddling like crazy under the water. Sometimes you need to know that it's paddling like crazy under the water instead of just the fact that it's floating very nicely on the water. You know what I mean? And I think a lot of people are afraid of that. It's like, don't be afraid of that. I wrote for 40 odd years, and the crowd just got bigger. They didn't get smaller.
And that's the thing there, like, because you're putting your stories into a paper that's broad spectrum. People pick it up. Yep. They might be lower class, upper class, man, woman, so on and so forth. Yep. It's changed now where it's ultra specific. You talked about giving analysis. Now people want the analysis of a story and stuff. Do you mean in a basketball context, do you mean like a real kind of X's and O's? Here's Casper Ware coming off a drag screen with the, you know, maybe you've seen these types of articles
The likes. Yeah,
that's where I've often, that's too much. Where have you got an example of the line that you like?
I like you to explain why this team beat that team, but not, well, you know, in the 13th minute of the second half when they switched to a 2-1-2 and then they came out of that. And then, the average punter doesn't want to know that stuff. And the basketball lover will recognize it. And there's a place for that story as well. But that's not the mainstream. The mainstream you've got to talk to your audience as if it's intelligent. Like, one of the things I was first taught as a journalist was always presume the person that's reading the story knows nothing about it. Well, you know what? I never did that. I always thought, if the person's reading this...
Because I've heard that before and thought that was peculiar.
Yeah, well, I thought, if you're reading this, you already know something about it. You're interested. So I'm not going to treat you like some dummy that I've got to really, really dumb it down for. I'm going to presume you're coming with me and on this particular journey of this story. And that always seemed to work, you know? So I didn't have to go into super duper detail, but I needed to tell you what happened in the game or preview and predict what could happen and what the best matchups were for you to see, telling you that, you know, Leroy Loggins up against Robert Rose, you've got to go and see this. This is just two of the greatest athletes in right. One's past his prime, but he's still great. One's, you know, the new version of him. You know, and you sell to the public what is going to be really interesting about this game. You're not selling
Were you mindful of commercialism? Were you mindful of, if I phrase this in a certain way that's like, hey, you got to get out and buy a ticket? Or did you let the interest come quite naturally, or the interest to purchase come quite naturally?
No, I did both, because there were times I think Nate Jawai is in town. You have to see this man play. This is the first time he's come into town with Cairns. And at that, you know, he had an outstanding rookie season. I was like, you've got to go. If you like basketball, get your butt down there, because this guy is going to amaze you. I did that. But I also did enough sort of background stories leading up to something so that the reader would be already aware that, Southeast Melbourne's coming to town. And, you know, they're 2-1 on us this season. This is a big game for the 36ers. You know, there was already a level of awareness that you created. That's why I feel a lot of the time people say, Adelaide has the most knowledgeable crowd in Australia. I'm not sure that's the case. It's certainly not the case anymore. But I think the fan base here was very, very strong and very, very up with it. So I didn't need to know that, you know. Yeah, on a skip screen or on a, they didn't need that sort of detail.
Yeah, right.
That sort of detail is for someone like you who might want to know that.
Mm. Yeah, I agree.
I don't care.
Interesting stuff. No. There's a fine line. That stuff's too far. I do like to look at, I mean, stats are a new thing where I think people just see stuff are quite numbers focused now, more so, not, but still numbers. So there's nice to have a few stats thrown in there just to give that side of the palate a bit of a tickle.
Yep.
What I'll say is, first I just want to say on the memoir, the stuff about hand-me-downs, being one of four brothers, really good. It's got a sort of David Thoreau, Walden Pond about it, but not as politically angsty if you've read that book. It's the idea of seeing a shirt. It was bizarre, these sort of, you'd see your brother would get something, your older brother would be like, I'm going to enjoy that in 4 years.
When I get it, it's going to have all this life experience in it.
that was one of my favorite paragraphs, I think. Going back to the thing, Basketball Hall of Fame. You've won Writer of the Year a number of times. I don't know how many. You could tell me if you wish. Not in the Hall of Fame. Does it bother you? Do you care? Should you be? Shouldn't be? I guess that's the question I'll start with. Should you be in there?
Are you comfortable? Probably, yeah, I probably should. But I can understand why I'm not. You know, leadership of organizations turns over. You know, new people come in, and the longer it goes, the less chance you have, okay? Because someone like, say, like a Gerald Richter who's there now, she wouldn't know me from, you know,
right.
The next person. So what are my chances of ever being in the Hall of Fame? I'd say they'd be very, very slim. Should I maybe
do you appreciate it?
Oh, absolutely. I would think that would be a wonderful recognition of a body of work, and I would be very proud and humbled to be there. But I'm not expecting to be. That's not something that keeps me awake nights or is problematic. I don't expect that to happen. Across the years, people have told me in the past that, I'm pushing for you and this and that, and you kind of listen to it and go, yeah, whatever. I don't anticipate it happening. I really don't.
If the NBA, we said this before, 41 years, which is a decent chunk of time, and it's not nothing, it's a good chunk of time, and it's a good history. And, you know, leagues, 41 years, civilizations have risen and fallen. If the NBL tapped you on the shoulder and said, we're going to do sort of a, before every contest, we're going to have a quick look at the history of something and put out an article or something like that. Do you think that would be, first of all, would that excite you, and would you like to do it? And secondly, do you think people would want to read it, and would it garner interest?
I would like to think the arrogance that I have is the arrogance in my belief that I can make people read something. That if they start, they'll want to finish. That I hope that's the case. And it's been my experience to be the case. So I have no qualms about my abilities as a writer. I'm a good writer. I'm not a great writer, but I'm a good writer, and I can get a person to read. So if the NBL was to come to me with something like that, I would be very interested in doing it. And whether the public's initial reaction to it would be positive or negative wouldn't bother me, because I think if you start reading it, you're going to read it.
Yeah, right.
So I would be happy to do that. But when I retired, I did send out a few emails to a number of organizations and clubs and saying, you know, if you need a resource or whatever, you know, or someone to write some press releases for you, whatever. I'm here. I'm happy to do it. I'm not going to charge the earth. I'm retired. I'm not troubled. Mm-hmm. But very few people took me up on it. BA took me up on it FIBA took me up on it for a little while. FIBA Oceania. But generally speaking, I think because I wrote without fear or favor as a journalist, I think there's a sort of a reluctance to employ me for fear that I'm just going to do whatever the hell I want to do. But if you're working right. for somebody, you are going to present the information in a way that appeals to them. So
sympathetic, yeah.
Yeah, but I think I was honestly, I think I was a bit too intimidating for some people.
Lastly, we are here. We've talked about writing for a long while, but we are here on a podcast, new media. I mean, you've done a number of these podcasts. You got Brad and Body podcast going on. Do you see something there in that space that you like? And more importantly, that if you'd had access to it before, you know, radio, TV, it's a different medium. You can't do what works in print won't work in this form. I guess that's not even a question. It's more of a statement. But what do you like about it? What would you do in the space other than Brad and Body?
Oh, I like what we were doing with Brad Rosen and myself. I thought that had potential. I the overtime program. I'm going to make a confession. I don't watch it, but I see the little ads for it, and I might watch, you know, a 20-second grab here and there. But that's the sort of program I think our sport can use. You know, and I
agreed.
I'm not necessarily as enamored with the way they present it as, you know, some of the formats I've seen from in NBA broadcasting, where, you know, you have people sitting around and chatting about issues. I think that's a good way to go. I hope someone picks that up soon as an idea. In joke, folks, sorry.
I agree. I think, yeah, sorry, you're saying.
I was just saying that I like the podcast world. I think it's very good. You know, people like Adam Gibson put out some good stuff.
Yeah.
There's good stuff out there, but the danger is you get swamped and there's so much. Then you go, well, what? There's going to be just small audiences for everybody, unless that you're particularly outstanding. And that's, yeah, I don't know. I don't. Yeah.
Overtime, I think my only problem with overtime is it's the one shot. It's broadsheet. I mean, that show, I really look at it and think, if you're 12 years old, if you're 52 years old or 72 years old, man or woman, like that is a great introduction. You can watch that and you kind of get a sense of the characters. You get a sense of what's going on. It's good. My question is, why not more? How the NBL doesn't have a show for kids in their early teens and preteens? It's, you know, who was the guy? Was it Kipes? He used to do a show. He was a very funny guy. He did this silly little show for kids. Saturday Morning Hoops, Steve Cuffin. That stuff, you have that. And then you have Overtime that's quite broadsheet. And then you have something that's really quite maybe even adult. I think, you know, there's no
NBL After Dark.
This is exactly, well, that was the title of it. NBL After Dark, where it's a little bit more, where it's 18 plus and it, you know, caters to that audience. I think that, that I would like to see that, but. What do you think?
Yeah, where do the players go at Christmas? Ho, ho, ho. What does that really mean?
Good one. Body, that's all I've really got.
That's fine. And for those of you still with us, thank you for hanging in.
Basketball journal, there's a lot going on. I've always said your memoirs should be called Nodge, Nodge, Wink, Wink.
Yeah, Brian Gorgia would change that to Nodge, Nodge, Wank, Wank.
I'm sure that he would. Buddy, any final words?
Yeah, it's been a pleasure. Talk to you again soon, I hope.
That's it for this episode of the NBL Pocket Podcast. I really hope you enjoyed it, and a sincere thank you for listening. If you're new to the program and you've come here following Botty's talk of memoirs, subscribe to the show. Why not? Just click the button that says, funnily enough, subscribe. And leave a rating and review if you would be so kind. Be honest. If you thought it was good, give a good one. If you thought it was bad, give a bad one. Thank you so much, and I'll see you next week.